United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Welcome to the Seminary Explores. I'm your host for today, Don Redman, and with me is Jason Hatch, the artist in residence at the Gettysburg National Military Park for January and February 2020. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you here. So you are the artist in residence at the National Military Park this month, and You've in some of your writings and things, you've talked about how art was a way for you to relieve stress and things like that. But before we get into that, I'm wondering if you want to give us a little bit of your background and just where you're from as a person.
So. Sure. I grew up in central Wyoming. I joined the Army in 1988. I initially was enlisted, and then I had gotten out in 1991. Entered into the Army ROTC program at the University of Wyoming, and then received my commission in May of 95 as a lieutenant back in armor. I was an armor and cavalry officer for most of my operational career. I served all the way up on tanks, primarily through the invasion of Iraq. I was in my second command when the invasion kicked off, so we were part of the lead main effort during the invasion, all the way up from the Kuwaiti border to Baghdad. And then I changed command in Baghdad. And then I left the operational world and became was nominated for a defense attaché position. So I went to work for the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Secretary of Defense's office as a military attaché in sub-Saharan Africa, which was my geographic area of choice. And then I served the last 8 years there in several African countries, primarily West Africa.
Okay. Can you explain what the basic role of a military attaché is?
Sure. You have a lot of bosses. You work for the ambassador. You advise the ambassador on all military matters. You work for the Secretary of Defense, and you have a representational function for him or her with the host nation military and other multilateral engagement opportunities. You also administer security assistance programs. So, you know, my office would run HIV/AIDS programs. We would build clinics and testing programs. Any joint operations that might be going on in the country, we would play a major role in that. Ship visits, those kind of things. You also had a humanitarian assistance role, so we would build clinics and stuff, primarily infrastructure centric. Things which aren't very popular right now, but they have a lasting impact. And then I also administered some biodiversity funds for reforestation and so forth. And then your day-to-day functions, you know, you work a lot with the host nation military, you liaise a lot with your counterparts from other countries, you know, and a lot of the countries I served in were experiencing significant civil unrest, or, you know, had gone through coups and counter coups and, you know, multiple iterations of that. Narco trafficking was a major issue. So you play a pretty big role in that. A lot of these countries, you know, as a fallout from the Cold War, you know, the militaries are some of the only institutions that still exist. You know, a lot of times they have the guns, so, you know, they exert a little more authority than they probably should. So you have a role to play there because you wear a uniform, and, you know, a lot of times it's a little bit easier to go out and deal with them than the ambassador, you know, driving down with a convoy and trying to straighten some of these people out. So it was challenging. I've enjoyed it significantly. Parts of it I didn't enjoy. It's hard to see that stuff, you know, especially having come out of Iraq, and it takes a toll on people. I'm sure any expat or anyone who's ever gone abroad, a lot of missionaries, you know, I mean, tried to work a lot with the missionary groups over there because they're effective, and they go there and they stay. And, you know, that's not the same as a lot of the NGOs and stuff. They'll go in, spend $500,000, you know, and then they'll leave, and, you know, the project never gets off the ground. And, you know, it's hard for someone to see people begging on the streets, or someone who's been affected by polio walking on their hands, you know. It takes a toll. So it was difficult.
It sounds like, and maybe you can speak to this, is that you've served on both kind of both sides, the hearts and mind side, as well as the combat side of military service. And it sounds like they're both very challenging, each in their own ways.
Yeah. I mean, combat is fairly straightforward. You know, there's a hill, go take the hill, you know, pound it, clobber with artillery, whatever you got to do. It's the aftermath that's challenging, you know, and I saw that in Baghdad. I mean, it was surreal. Some of the things you would never imagine you'd have to deal with, but, you know, villagers coming up to you, and we'd think they'd need food, but they don't need food. They need medical attention. We hadn't planned for, you know, extra supplies to treat people that were often wounded by our actions or the Fedayeen who we were fighting against. You know, traffic accidents and all this stuff still continue to happen. You know, you don't imagine that, you know, having to deal with that. But, you know, somebody gets hit on a bicycle and you have to drive them into your aid station, or should you? You know, I mean, those were moral quandaries that we faced that we really hadn't considered. It was challenging, but the aftermath part is a lot harder. And that actually lended itself pretty well to what I did as an attaché, because it was strengthening, you know, the democratic process and, you know, trying to develop a professional military that is under civilian control and, you know, respects the Constitution, which I think we've done a pretty good job of in our military, and then kind of setting an example and maybe helping where you can. And it was helpful growing up where I grew up in Wyoming, because my cousins had lived out on the reservation. We lived right, it's technically on the Wind River Reservation. My grandfather had actually sheltered there during the Depression and made it through the Depression, making silver belt buckles and stuff. That he was Navajo. So you can't help but grow up on a reservation. You know, any thoughts of racism or bigotry or whatever kind of get beaten out of you at the bus stop. So, you know, I think that made working with Africans a little easier for me, if that makes sense. So
when you retired, you kind of continued this, because then you went into working with human trafficking in Africa.
Well, I mean, I had to overcome a real drinking problem first, to be honest. They would probably need to create a new word other than drunk to describe what I was. I was a wreck when I retired, and, you know, it took me a year and a half to pull myself together. I bought an RV and went on the road, you know, for a year and a half, just trying to rediscover my own country. I'd lived abroad for so long. And anyway, I cleaned myself up, got my head screwed on straight, and I had met a really amazing group of people, senior academics and, you know, some folks that I had worked with in Africa, and a human rights attorney, and my old boss from the intelligence agency, and we kind of put together a consulting group that focused on macro disaster resilience, so looking at, you know, regional issues like the tsunami in, you know, the southeastern Pacific, and other problems like human trafficking. This is something that I run across in Africa, and I did my thing, and I wrote a report, and you send it back on a classified channel, and you just assume that there's an office full of suits in Reston or Clarendon or Langley, then they're going to run out and take care of it. And then you realize that there is no office, and, you know, it's just good to know information for people in Washington. Nobody's really tackling it, with the exception of a lot of the faith-based groups, a lot of some good NGOs that are out there. Law enforcement, you know, would gladly tackle it, but, you know, it's a who thought you'd be dealing with slavery in the 21st century? I mean, I certainly didn't. So a lot of my work was still in Africa, Francophone Africa. I speak French. Never write that on your reports when you join the military. It'll come back to bite you. But a lot of my work would take place in the early morning, and I had rented an office in Winchester and was working out of the office. You can only read so many books and watch so many movies at night when you're waiting to do Skype calls with partners, you know, because of the time difference. So I started making art, painting, sculpting. I have no training, and I do not consider myself an artist. I consider myself, you know, a dabbler and a scribbler. I found a real release there and a lot of healing power in it, just being occupied with that kind of stuff. So decided to go back to school just to get a fine arts degree, just associate's degree at the local college there where I was living in Winchester, and just ran into a real amazing group of professors and, you know, artists and writing professors. And then my focus kind of shifted to writing over the last year. So got into film through writing scripts. And then now I've embarked on writing a play, you know, again, with a purpose, you know, with the hopes of highlighting issues that, you know, I ran across while I was in Africa and the Middle East. And, you know, this one is about child soldiers. So it's very good therapy. And there are a lot of great groups out there that are helping out veterans, you know, to kind of overcome PTSD or, you know, whatever they're dealing with. And art's a great way to do it.
Okay. And the play that you're working on, I believe it's called Rope Tension, is
yes.
that correct? And that's going to be part of your installment here at the National Military Park.
Yes.
And I guess you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, Rope Tension, that's the name of the drums that they carried in the Civil War. They had rope bound around the skins. And so I chose that because it's emblematic of the play. I came up with the idea for it when I was actually at Antietam. I was there in an evening and sitting below a bluff where the Burnside Bridge is. And just imagined, you know, what it would be like after the battle, during the night, for a child who had witnessed everything, you know, the slaughter that had gone on during the day, and then trying to process all of that at night. So the play really is about two Civil War drummers that, one north, one south, they get separated from their units during a battle, any battle. I decided to be non-specific, and I can't find any reference in historical reference that this actually ever occurred. At the same time, we all know it probably occurred 1,000 times throughout history. They both get separated from their units, and after the initial back and forth, you know, the Billy Yank and Johnny Reb stuff, you know, they both realize they're kids and they're afraid of the dark. And so they end up spending the night together and, you know, finding common ground in their childhood while reconciling everything that's around them on the day, in the day-to-day. And then, you know, they're forced to deal with a serious threat that is, comes up during the course of the night. And, you know, it really gets dark and they have to become men way too soon. And so that's really what it's about. And it's a simple play. It's nothing fancy. I think I found that those have been the most interesting to me. And, you know, my message is meant to be timeless, not constricted to just the Civil War.
Right, because and an area that you've worked in is the children soldiers in Africa. And, I mean, why can you explain why this is so important to you?
Well, like the sex trafficking and the human trafficking, this is not a problem I ever imagined, you know, I'd witness. And when I say I worked on it, please don't get me wrong. I didn't have my hands in it like others who are actually working in it, and full credit to those folks that actually are dealing with it. Through my office, I supported a few local efforts with funding and, you know, equipment and stuff like that. But I also observed quite a bit. And, you know, I'm a graduate of the Kofi Annan Center in Accra, Ghana. And my roommate's, General Alhaji Babacar Faye, who's at the Senegalese officer who's currently on staff with the UNDPKO, which is the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. He's dealt with this. Other friends, John Melamano in Africa and others, you know, have kind of relayed their experiences to me. And it's all horrific. On a trip to Guinea-Bissau in 2004, we'd actually gone down to find the government. There had been a military mutiny and the government had gone into hiding. So we were sent down from Senegal to find the government, you know, and kind of get an idea of what was going on. And there was an NGO there, and it's a Portuguese-speaking country. And there was an NGO there that was doing some work. I think it was PDDRI. And they were primarily focused on demilitarization, demobilization. And these are efforts that are going on in a lot of parts of sub-Saharan Africa just because of the conflict and the fallout over the years. And so I sat for a whole day with these folks and just got, you know, a taste of what they were dealing with and was able to listen in on a couple of the counseling sessions with children who had been recruited by the Balanta tribesmen at the time who were in charge of the military, you know, to go out and do things that were pretty horrible. And again, you know, up until I went to war, you know, you'd read stories about Johnny Clem and, you know, other people, you know, who joined the military at a very early age, snuck in or whatever, and you kind of idolize them, you know, and they're mythologized in our society, not just our culture, but you see it in Europe, you see it in Africa, you see it everywhere, as people who, you know, heard the clarion call and went to war way before their time, and oh, how patriotic. And then I went to war, and you see what it does, and nobody should ever, certainly not a child, should see those things, should hear those things, do those things, smell those things. It's not a place for children. And I can't imagine having been exposed to that at 9 years old or 10 years old, the hard slog you have the rest of your life to pull yourself out of it. So while my play is set during the Civil War, my intent is that it has a contemporary message that goes beyond that, and that these efforts to keep children out of conflict areas and situations like that, as much as we possibly can, you know, they should be supported. And good people who are capable, you know, if they're looking for something to do with their lives, that's a worthy endeavor.
Well, would you like to read a little bit of your play for us?
Sure. This is from my very recently crafted second act. It's the first scene, and I'm introducing the antagonist into the script. So the scene is midnight. There's a campfire below a steep bluff, and it's the night after a fierce battle. Two drummer boys, one north, one south, they've become separated from their units and have fallen down the bluff. They're sharing a fire for the night. A loud thrashing and grunting is heard. A stranger is running down the bluff, trips and falls, and strikes his head on a rock. He staggers into the firelight and collapses. The man is not wearing a uniform, but is bedraggled and looks to have been in the day's battle. There is much blood on his shirt. The boys hesitate, then warily approach the figure. Caleb checks and sees he is still breathing. They struggle to drag him closer to the fire and roll him onto his back. Then they retreat to the far side of the fire and huddle together on a log, watching him. Caleb. He don't look like one of ourn. Them boots is new. Got laces and all. Thomas. He ain't wearing a uniform that I seen afore. Those trousers look sieve. Could be one of us, though, as I heard lots of New York fellows got on the train in Albany, got off at Manassas, were handed a rifle and went straight into the fight, top hats still on their heads. Caleb, his bleeding is done. Don't see no wound, though. Wonder where he was hit. Thomas, we had a corporal in B Company named Denny. He got hit at Chancellorsville and walked around for 2 days with a mini in his head. He fell down dead waiting in line for biscuits, eyes full of blood one night. 2 days? Lordy Lord, nobody seen a wound? Nobody saw nothing. He just fell. Stranger groans and moves slightly. Caleb, well, he ain't breathing shaller. Sergeant says if they breathing regular, they in good shape to live. Thomas, I wonder who he is and what's he doing out here at night anyways. Caleb, Arn Pickett's would have shot him sure. Thomas, ours too. I used to run coffee out to the Pickett's and they is a jumpy bunch. Maybe he got lost like us. Caleb, could be lost, could be a runt. I'd kill me a battalion for some coffee nows. Haven't seen hide nor hair since we come over the Potomac. With a little bit of drip of molasses. Stranger groans and kicks foot out slightly. Thomas, do you think? Caleb, think what? Thomas, he's a deserter? Caleb looks at the stranger with disgust and spits on the ground. Thomas, but from which side? Caleb, they're all the same cowards. Thomas, he'll kill us for sure if he is. We've seen him. And the rest goes on from there. But that's the point where they've come together and kind of put aside their nationalistic tendencies and realized they need to stick together.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. So you've kind of pulled your life history kind of into this work and what you've seen. You're taking your personal experiences, seeing what children have experienced, kind of merge those together and kind of seeing the reality of how it's impacting people around the world, really. I mean, it's a problem everywhere. And again, we can see, I think, why art became important, a way to start to work through these experiences and what you've had to face in your life.
So. That's very true. It's, you know, I've done a couple different programs that, you know, one at VCU, sponsored by Creative Vets, and screenwriting workshops and stuff. And the veteran community, you know, I think there's like this expectation that, you know, if I go do one of these things and I have to recreate the blood and the guts and stuff that I saw and, you know, those horrors, and somehow that's, I think a lot of civilians kind of, that's how we're supposed to draw our poison out. And maybe that's true for a lot of folks, you know, but for me, I'm choosing kind of the oblique, I guess, you know, so I don't honestly need to revisit the invasion of Iraq, you know, and the things that happened there to treat my depression or whatever you want to call it. You know, I can work on beautiful things or, you know, informative things and things that, you know, have a strong moral message from the side. And that's what I'm doing with this play, and really with a lot of my art, is it's not focused on the blood and guts. You know, I'm not sure. I know there's an appetite for that, but it's not an appetite I want to feed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, very much so. You know, I don't think we can promote essentially peace by glorifying the horrible things that happen in life. I mean, we have to acknowledge them, we have to face them, but we don't have to glorify them, I think. And I think that can be very important. So. Well, I think we've had a pretty good discussion today. I really appreciate you coming in and sharing with us. I do want to offer you Seminary Ridge Museum here on the Gettysburg campus, two tickets to go tour that, including the cupola tour. So you can stand where Buford stood and take a look around town. So, And we have been talking today with Jason Hatch, the artist in residence at the Gettysburg National Military Park for January and February of 2020, and the author of Rope Tension, which you read a little bit for us. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.